There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for tuning into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, Tim Dennis. We are freshly back from Gettysburg, where we had an amazing time with the crew from NEPI, the New England Paranormal Investigators, I think it is. They are great. It's such a fun event to get back to phenomenology and see all of our friends. So thank you again for a wonderful time. Thank you to all of you that came on out to meet us and spend some time with us. We appreciate that as well. Hey, I want to make a quick mention. I'm going to be out at the Belvoir Winery coming up in July, and I would love the chance to meet you. There are just a handful of tickets still available. You can find a link at darknessevents.com. It's like a night in Havana, which I'm not quite sure about the title, but it takes place in Liberty, Missouri. So I think she's got a fun little party plan around the deal. So I'll be out there. I think Cindy Kaza, I just found out, is going to be a part of it. Amy and Adam from Kindred Spirits are going to be there. Our buddy Greg Lawson's on hand. So there's a lot of cool people going to be at the event. That's coming up in July. Get your tickets right now by going to darknessevents.com. All right, we've got to start off, folks. Big news abounds. You know, the UFO situation, the report is due any day now from people looking at it and speculating about what's coming out and some of the early leaked information. I think it's kind of what we've expected. It's going to be subjective. I think it's going to be inconclusive and subjective. But let's talk about a couple of the news stories. Our first one comes from Fox News. This is an audio daily double. Let's go ahead and hear that one, Tim.
Intel officials apparently found no evidence of aliens being responsible for the UFOs recently spotted by U.S. Navy pilots. But it's also not ruling it out. Jeremy Corbell is an investigative filmmaker. He's been on this story for years. Jeremy, welcome back and good morning. Good morning to you. I don't know what else is going to be in this report. The New York Times gave us a teaser last week. What did you take from that, Jeremy? Let's start there.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's the question. We now know that UFOs are real. We know that they're not U.S. government black projects, and it's becoming increasingly clear that these are not Russian or Chinese technologies because they, too, have UFO study programs. So that's the question. We need to leave the door open now to more exotic explanations.
Bill Nelson's former senator, of course, astronaut. He had this to say.
I have talked to those Navy pilots, and they are sure that they saw something real. We don't know if it's extraterrestrial. We don't know if it's an enemy. We don't know if it's an optical phenomenon. The bottom line is, we want to know, and that's what we're trying to do.
Jeremy, do you think are we any closer to having any knowledge about it? I mean, if they're going to come out and say, well, we still don't know, do we not know?
Right. So Bill doesn't know in that clip. I mean, but he's saying the right thing. We need to find out. They seem to be playing a game of catch up within the Department of Defense and obviously within NASA now, which is, you know, focusing on this subject. The UFO topic has been studied by the Department of Defense for decades. We have non-terrestrial exploitation programs that are, compartmentalized. So this is something that they need to pass the information around, and at least we're asking the right questions.
Okay,
now.
But they didn't say in that story, Jeremy, that it was an unidentified flying object. What they suggested that it could be what's called hypersonic technology, which is a way through moving.
Yeah, that's incorrect.
Well, hang on. But that's what the story said. And because of that, they suggested that perhaps the Russians or the Chinese, if that is the case and true, then we might be literally light years behind them and their technology.
Right. You know, that's a charade. These objects are not just hypersonic objects. These objects show stationary duration for weeks at a time. And also, this has been something that's proven to be going on for over 70 years. So if we're talking about technology beyond 1,000 years from what we have now, who had that 50 years ago? Where has it been for 50 years?
Fair question, but if they've been out there for 70 years, our photography has gotten so much better. Why don't we have a better picture of this, Jeremy?
Oh, well, we certainly do, Bill, and that's what's exciting about this. That's why Commander Underwood filmed the Tic Tac UFO. That corroborates eyewitness testimony from multiple pilots, as you saw in the 60 Minute episode with Commander David Fravor. Additionally, I obtained and released radar data from these types of events where UFOs swarmed Navy warships. So we do have better photographs. We do have better imagery and sensor data now.
We like to see them.
Yeah.
Jeremy.
Fascinating.
Well, they're
Thank
out
you.
There. I put it out there.
On your website.
No, all over the world. They're all over the world now.
All right. Well, you know what? Keep coming back. We have lots of questions. Thank you.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we could go on for a long time here, but we're out of time. Jeremy, thank you. Good
You're
luck
great.
To you.
Thank
Jeremy
you.
Corbell. We'll get the report from the U.S. government sometime in June.
First of all, who's the doofus host of that? Do you know who he is, Tim?
I'm not familiar, to be honest with you.
Neither am I, but I just got to say, I love that he's so, well, they didn't say, and they didn't, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, right, they didn't, but relax, give him a chance to respond, and he kept trying to talk over Jeremy to make a point that really didn't fit for that aspect, and then, well, where's all the good footage? Well, the government's released a bunch of good footage. Yeah, well, when are we going to see it? It's been out for a year, jackass. That's what's getting all this excitement. There's good footage. There's clear. As a matter of fact, during the news segment, and this clip will be up at darknessradio.com. Go click on the news tab. During the news segment, they're showing some of the most crystal clear images of those pyramid UFOs. Best images I've seen. Now, I've had questions, too. I've said that. Why, if it's the military, are we getting this grainy black and white nonsense? Why? I can't believe we don't have high definition when we can read license plates from outer space on a satellite.
Absolutely.
But we can't get a better shot of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I also have wondered, and if there's anybody out there that knows this, are some of these cameras that we're seeing, they almost look night vision-esque. Is it because these craft are not showing up on radar? So some normal cameras are not identifying them, so they're using different visual spectrums in order to capture the image. Because if radar or sonar, all these things are not picking up on it, is it in a different visual perspective? That's why they're trying to use these cameras to get those shots. I'm not sure. So if somebody out there knows, let us know. Now, to follow up from that, Microsoft News has an article out that says UFO expert says aliens may or may not be out there, but technological artifacts exists that are way beyond our comprehension, which I think is an interesting follow. An expert on UFOs said there are no concrete evidence to show whether aliens may or may not be out there, but there are technological artifacts that exists way beyond our current comprehension. In May, a former U.S. Navy pilot told CBS 60 Minutes that pilots training off the U.S. coast sighted UFOs, also known as UAPs, now unidentified aerial phenomena. They're seeing it nearly every day. In 2019, the Department of Defense launched a special task force to investigate videos of UAP. A report of the sightings found no evidence that UAP sightings belong to aliens, but said so little is known that it cannot be ruled out. University of Southern California professor Madhu Thanglavu, and I'm sure I butchered that, but I apologize, told Insider that what pilots saw may not be extraterrestrial in origin, as there still isn't any public evidence that aliens exist. But that doesn't mean the possibility is off the table. In the scientific field, the material evidence is important, he said. Now, NASA is also looking into UAP. NASA's new chief, Bill Nelson, told CNN last week that the agency is setting up an investigation to further look into flying objects. Nelson said he doesn't think the UFOs prove the existence of aliens, but said he referred to scientists who could better explain what they are. We don't know if it's extraterrestrial. We don't know if it's an enemy. We don't know if it's an optical phenomena, as you heard in that last story. We don't think it's optical phenomena because of the characteristics that those Navy pilots described. And so the bottom line is, we want to know. Thang Le Vu, who worked in both the engineering and architecture departments at USC, said these videos do show things that can't be easily explained. It's possible that we'll see more evidence as things happen, he said, referring to the Pentagon report and further investigations into UFOs. There's also the possibility that the technologies that are employed are what is causing this rapid movement that they talk about that cannot be explained using our physics or our engineering, he said. However, whatever is piloting these craft is not likely human, or if they are human, they're probably not on board drone technology. Very simply, when we talk about these things that are moving very fast, if there was a human being inside, they would simply be crushed because of the acceleration. However, Thang Le Vu said that when talking about other life forms, it's important to categorize what's being seen into three categories based on the proximity of the interaction. The first being where someone sees something they can't explain from far away. The second is when something is witnessed in close proximity. Finally, the third is actual face-to-face interaction with an alien. Thang Le Vu said that all the interactions being talked about so far are from afar, which makes it harder to really tell what the Navy pilots are witnessing. Thang Le Vu also said that our technology and innovation span over a relatively small amount of time in history, and it's possible that what we're seeing are innovations that we haven't completely understood. So whether it's aliens, new technology, or other countries, or top secret projects by the U.S., the ability to understand it is hindered by the scope of what we know, which is a lot of political rhetoric for giving you an answer without an answer. NPR, however, said that the report found the objects witnessed were not created in classified programs by the U.S. or the Pentagon, which is still very worrisome. To put it simply, Thang Le Vu quoted the inventor and writer Arthur C. Clarke, who said, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." However, even if what's being seen is the work of aliens, Thang Le Vu says there's no reason for anyone to panic. And while he said this could be advanced technology, he rejected theories that they're being used to spy on the U.S. by rivals and said if they were, we would have already felt the consequences, which I firmly believe. If, and that's Dave saying that, if it were a spying operation, then we should see the consequence of that in some of our actions. And I'm not aware of anything that suggests that whatever is looking at us or running around is affecting our intelligence community to date, because if they were, we would know about it. So that's it. Now, Tim, you had an interesting perspective on this. You do talks at these conferences, and you do a talk on aliens and conspiracies and ghost EVP and things. But well, in your conspiracy, you've actually been talking about something for quite a while, which seems to be playing in. So I'm gonna yield the floor to the good representative from the state of Minnesota, Tim Dennis.
Well, in my anatomy of a conspiracy talk, Dave, we break down why people believe in conspiracy theories. Okay. And in that, we talk about the phenomena of believing in the conspiracy of aliens and UFO, and whether people believe in the conspiracy theory of UFOs and why. And in that, I bring up the honest truth of whether we're being worked on this entire thing. And as I was reviewing the talk before I brought it out to Gettysburg, I remembered I had this clip in the talk, and I thought, wow, is this timely? And I'd never brought it up on the show before. And then Friday came, and a news story came out from ABC News saying basically that the ABC News story said that an official that came out and had read the report said that the findings said that the report says that essentially what you've said here, that it could be just technology, that it's not necessarily aliens. But then I remembered this clip, and this clip was President Bill Clinton talking to Jimmy Kimmel. And I'm going to let it speak for itself, and then let's talk about it afterwards, okay? It's about It's about 3 minutes long, but it is very intriguing, and here it is.
We're back. Manny Pacquiao is on the way. President Bill Clinton is here with us. So if I was president, and I won't be, let's be honest, the first thing I would do after putting my hand on that Bible and taking that oath to serve the country is I wouldn't even probably finish the oath. I would run to the White House. I'd demand to see all the classified files on the UFOs. Because I want to know. I'd want to know what has been going on. Did you do that?
Sort of. Yeah, we had... I think it was at the beginning of my second term, we had the anniversary of Roswell.
You waited that long?
I did.
Wow.
Well, I didn't. And then there's also Area 51. You remember there was a great sci-fi movie where there was an alien kept deep under the ground
in
Area 51? So first I had people go look at the records on Area 51 to make sure there was no alien down there. And people thought that because everybody who works there has to stop about an hour away and put on special clothing and then drive in and out. And that's because a lot of our stealth technology is made there. We know that now. But there are no aliens there. So then when the Roswell thing came up, I knew we'd get, you know, gazillions of letters. So I had all the Roswell papers reviewed, everything.
If you saw that there were aliens there, would you tell us?
Yeah.
You would.
Well, I think, look, what do we know? We know now we live in an ever-expanding universe. We know that there are billions of stars and planets literally out there, and the universe is getting bigger. We know from our fancy telescopes that just in the last 2 years, more than 20 planets have been identified outside our solar system that seem to be far enough away from their suns and dense enough that they might be able to support some form of life. So it makes it increasingly less likely that we're alone.
Oh, you're trying to give me a hint that there are aliens.
No, I'm trying to tell you I don't know.
Oh.
But if we were visited someday, I wouldn't be surprised. I just hope that it's not like Independence Day.
Yeah, right. Maybe,
that it's, a conflict.
Well, now we have friendly
aliens. Maybe the only way to unite this incredibly divided world of ours. They're out there. We better... Think of how all the differences among people on Earth would seem small if we felt threatened by a space invader. That's the whole theory of independence.
You're right. You're
right. Everybody gets together and makes nice and,
You and Bill O'Reilly would be hiding in a bunker together.
Oh, Bill O'Reilly, he'd be every mean thing he ever said about me. I don't care. Look at that.
Okay, so think about that for a second. Me and Bill O'Reilly in a bunker making nice because we saw an alien.
Okay, so there's two things in there I do not believe. One, if there were aliens, would you tell us? Yeah, I would. I don't believe he would. Second of all, me and Bill O'Reilly making nice. I don't believe that would happen. I believe Bill O'Reilly would be outside pounding on the door and Bill would be inside blowing weed smoke out through the crack at Bill going, too bad, so sad, but son of a bitch.
But see, here you're assuming and you're looking past the headline here, and here's the headline.
I'm just going for the quick comedy to let you do the rest. So please go ahead.
But here's the headline, and it's this. Bill basically told you in so many words, no, there are no aliens at Area 51, and there's a reason for that. We scared them away. There were initially, and I do believe there were at Roswell initially, but I believe we're too savage to keep welcoming them in. I think we scared the hell out of them.
Do you think we took the bodies and barbecued them and like made video and then beamed it back to space going, this is what's happening to you, buddy?
I think they probably came. I think they probably might have come back for a recon or tried to, but realized that for those dead bodies, but realized that we're such savages that they didn't want to interact with us and that they we did take their technology and we did use reverse technology, and maybe we're benefiting from the spoils of it, but they never did have another interaction with us again. And then secondly, and that's the aliens that landed at Roswell, keep that in mind. And then secondly, and here's the big reveal here, folks, and this is what he's telling you. This is, and I'm going to put this as plainly to you as the president just put it to you now. You're being worked. You've been worked for the last 6 months to a year. Things have broken down so badly in society that your government has just tried to misdirect you to put you back in line. That video, that grainy video that was just put out to you of aliens, the promise of disclosure that was put out to you, was meant to put you back in line. Because we've been arguing amongst ourselves politically because things went down at the Capitol, because we can't agree, because the left and the right have been clashing. And this isn't a political statement. This is reality. This is Tim sitting in the center telling you, because we can't be adults and we can't talk about the business of the country as business people, because you put your emotions into a place where you shouldn't. Because of that, they want you now to look up in the sky and they want you to huddle together and they want you to make nice. And they're using video technology to do it. They're using their own technology for you to do it.
And if this even goes back further to your point. This is a quote from 1987 from President Ronald Reagan with Mikhail Gorbachev. "Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize our common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world." He said that back in 1987.
And there you go.
So that's right to your point, right? Yep. So right now we've got a world in tumult and chaos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the pandemic didn't bring people closer. As a matter of fact, it caused a wider chasm and divide.
That's right.
You know, brought the world closer for about 2 weeks when everybody thought we were facing Ebola circumstances, right? And
yep.
Anybody that caught it was dead. Political derision, all of these other issues, and nothing has bonded us. So, right. Maybe you're right. Maybe that's why the soft disclosure during this major outbreak, and then nobody's reacting. So maybe we start stepping it up so that, and you know, I actually had a conversation with you about this in Gettysburg, and I said, but I don't think until they're hovering in our skies are people going to take it seriously.
Look what happened, Dave. I mean, it started out slowly. President Trump said, I'm gonna put all the papers out there. I'm gonna do this disclosure. I'm gonna do this, and nobody blinked. And then it was okay. Here's the videos, and nobody blinked. Instead, people wanted to fight each other, and they kept wanting to fight each other, and he kept promising more and more and more. And then I told you, well, you know what? You know what's gonna happen? Then Biden's gonna come in, and it's gonna get shut down. And everybody laughed, and they said, no, it's not gonna get shut down. It certainly is. You know why it was gonna get shut down? Because nobody cared.
Now, let me preface this, folks. Before you start crafting your angry emails or your iTunes reviews saying that we're talking politics, we're not taking sides. We're just mentioning, and it wasn't, well, Trump was trying to give us the freedom, Biden's trying to shut it down. He's evil, he's good, he's bad, he's good. It's none of that. It's just Biden, as Tim has said, Biden has been there before and knows what is going to be allowed out and not. And unfortunately, it's going to show on his record as though he's shutting it down.
I don't think
that's ever going to happen.
I think I'm making this clear. I'm not putting out political bias here. I'm telling you right.
You're making it clear, but people listen to it with a bias because we mentioned two names, Biden and Trump, and that's all they heard, and they're going to take sides.
If you think there's political bias here, there's something wrong with you. I'm just telling you right down the line. This is not a left and right thing. This is a America's not paying attention thing. And it has to do with you're not paying attention to what it is, the game that's being played. And this is how I put it in my talk. And I'll put it to you as plainly as I put it in my talk. And that's this. I've worked with two state senators, one on the left and one on the right. And I'll tell you this much, and I'll put it the way I put it in my talk. The state senators that I worked for, and I'll tell you this much, I've heard this also from other people that have worked for people in government, some of which are now presidents and vice presidents or former presidents and vice presidents. I've only met one former vice president that actually has cared about people and their constituents. The two that I used to work for could care less about you. They care about their PAC money. They don't care about you. And they certainly don't care about you, even if you donated $1 million to you. They could care less, much less say thank you after you gave them your donation. It comes down to this. If you so much as worship that person or put your attributes on that person, that's great for you, but they don't care about you. I wouldn't spend time worshiping these people. I wouldn't spend time putting your attributes on these people. This is how the forefathers intended it. They intended it for them to go to Congress, to serve their term, and to go back home to their jobs. That's all that this was supposed to be, to do the business of the country. Not to be worshipped like a deity. That's it. Don't make them a deity. Don't worship them like they are a deity. They're not. And that's how I put it in my talk. Mm-hmm. There's bad on both sides. And we're seeing a lot more of it lately. More than we used to. Much more than we used to. It used to be, even a few decades back, the business of the country, and you would be surprised. These days, you see a lot of vitriol for the camera. But I will guarantee you, when that camera goes off, both sides get together and they have a beer. They pat each other on the back. They shake each other's hands and they go count their money.
Kind of like wrestlers.
Exactly. Politics is like professional wrestling. They put on a good show in front of the camera, but they don't hate each other at all. In fact, they count their money, they shake each other's hands, and they go have a good time. They don't hate each other at all, trust me.
Crazy stuff. But let's get off politics, keep up with the
but
UFO
I'm just,
aspect.
Yeah,
of it,
but hey? I'm just, now I'm telling you, and I'm and this works back to my point. My point is this. There's a gain to all this, and the gain is this. Somebody makes money off this technology, and politicians get a kickback for these contracts. So those things that you see floating in the sky, somebody made money off of that. So there's money to be made through quote unquote disclosure or non-disclosure. So again, you all got worked. You see that the grainy footage of what you see on the news, that's not aliens. If we are seeing aliens in the sky or whatever alien contact you might have had, that might be genuine. That crap you saw on the news, that is an aliens. That was a work. And that's what I have to say.
We'll see when it unfolds. I'm still on the wall. I'm not sure where I feel. Obviously, you hear Timmy's passion for it. Sometimes I feel like he's on to something. Sometimes I feel like he's definitely on something, but hopefully time will tell. I see your point, and I do believe you might be right in the fact that aliens have been here and saw what assholes we were, and they decided not to hang out for long. But I don't know. There's still so many cases and so many people seeing things that I don't know. I don't know. We'll see how it unfolds. Interesting stuff. Speaking of interesting stuff, the new Conjuring movie is out.
Mm-hmm.
The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. Timmy and I both had a chance to watch that yesterday. And it's the third installment in the main Conjuring franchise. Yes, they made an appearance in a few others as little ancillary moments. But the three main, The Conjuring, Conjuring 2, The Enfield Poltergeist, and Conjuring, the new one, The Devil Made Me Do It, I liked it for what it was, and here's why. It's a little slower. It's got some good creep elements to it. It's a different kind of story than we've seen before. But what really I liked about it, Tim, was because it mirrored what we did with Lorraine Warren on her first interview.
This
taps more into the love story, but they don't, it's not shoving it down your throat, but it definitely shows more of the love story between Ed and Lorraine, and realizing how, I don't mean codependent in a bad way, but how codependent they were on one another. And I think it was beautifully done. If this is their swan song, at least for Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga as Ed and Lorraine, I thought it was a nice way to go out. There's something missing for me in the movie, and I couldn't put my finger on exactly what it was. But being the fans of true crime and paranormal that we are, I like this interesting blend, which made me go back and read more about the story. And I'm hoping to cover it on an upcoming True Crime Tuesday to go a little bit more in depth into the case. But I would say out of 5 stars, I feel confident giving it 3.5 stars for the new Conjuring flick. I'd love to see this universe continue, because I think out of, like, there's 10 movies, I think I've really enjoyed 7 to 8 of them. The first Annabelle movie I thought was kind of a waste, and The Nun I felt was the weakest next to the Annabelle movie, but I've really enjoyed all the rest.
You know, this movie felt more like Ed and Lorraine to me than the other two. This really, I think, having known Lorraine through interviews, this really feels like, I think Vera Farmiga really captures her spirit in this movie. And that's why I feel maybe more sentimental towards this movie than I did the other two. When I watch this movie, that kind of tickles the heartstrings. It may not, like you said, it may not be as strong as the other ones, but it is. And I figured it out when I was watching it, what it was that to me didn't seem as formidable as the other two. And it was maybe the strength of the villain.
Well, the villain was the devil. I mean, in this case,
well,
I thought
not
it was
really
decent, but they didn't make,
I mean, it isn't.
The sideline character creepy enough. Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah, you know, I mean, without spoiling it, it isn't. I mean, you know, but with that being said, I did think, you know, what I like about it is it starts, to use wrestling terms, it starts off hot. You know, the movie starts off with a bang right away. It's we get right into it. The one thing that I didn't like about the other movies in the Conjuring series that kind of didn't really deliver was it started off with a slow pace, and it kind of took some time to build, and there weren't.
But it definitely follows the formula of the other two ones, where you feel like you're coming off one case before going into the other.
Right.
It just so happens this one, the case they're starting with, ends up folding into the new case that they're dealing with. But I agree with you. This one started off a lot more freaky.
Right. Exactly. And with that too, I think the storytelling is also tighter. You know, I mean, the logic points are there. Everything blends in very well. You understand everything. They don't leave you hanging at any point. They take you on the ride from A to Z, and it's easy to follow along. Yet you don't quite see some of the twists coming, yet you do. You know, I mean, everything is good. With that being said, you're right. There is something missing. With that said, I'll say 3.75 for me. I did enjoy it a lot. I really did enjoy it a lot. And I did like the little touching moments between Ed and Lorraine. I thought,
which reminded me of our first episode with it,
yes,
right? I mean,
yeah,
we had that love story, and I should, you know, maybe I'll put links up to it again this week or this weekend. So if you haven't heard that first interview, I'll have links up, or if you're just scroll back literally into our first season, if you're listening on podcast tools, scroll back and check that out. Otherwise, check our social media this weekend. But we took her you know, obviously there's some paranormal, but we really took her back to the beginning. How did you meet Ed? How did you two come together? What was it like? And she was so thrilled that we made it about the relationship.
Right.
Equally as much as the paranormal. And that always touched me. And I'm glad that I'm glad I asked those questions.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm a little, as I was watching it too, I was remembering that interview, and I was remembering how touched she was that the two of you were talking about that. And part of me kind of wondered what she would think about seeing that on the screen. Part of me remembering how she could kind of quip about something quite quickly might have thought she might have said, well, it's about time. But the other part of me thinking, you know, I think she would have really been touched to have seen that on the big screen too.
I agree. But, you know, I think that the way they did it, again, not shoving it down our throats, we're not getting the love story. You get little flashes, but you see the love for element to me, to this whole story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so very cool. Check it out. See what your thoughts are on it, but it's a cool deal. I hope they, truthfully, I've been told, oh, they'll just keep milking this because of the franchise. And there are other stories to tell. I really want to see the werewolf story. I hope they do that because it's something different, and I would love for them to get into it. I would also love, they did a book called Satan's Harvest about Frenchie, and he was, that story creeped me the hell out when I read it. The book Satan's Harvest, you should pick it up. I'll see if it's on Amazon and put it in our Darkness Radio Amazon shop. And you can find that by going to darknessradio.com and click on the shop tab, and you'll see links there. But I that one is a story I'd like to see, but I can't remember if they touched on that in one of the other movies. Maybe it was in the Annabelle Comes Home when they kind of touch on a bunch of their different cases briefly, but I would love to see that one play out. And I think that there's enough meat on the bones for them to.
Is there still an issue with who owns most of the stories with these movies?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess they're getting over it because they delivered another case file of theirs that they legitimately were involved in. So,
yeah.
It's interesting. We'll have to see how it all plays out in the long game here. Hey, we want you to be a part of the show. Give us a call on our Voices from Beyond voicemail, 651-300-4977, 651-300-4977. Call in and share your paranormal encounters with us. We'd love to hear from you and hear your stories. So give us a call. Share your tales. We'll play them on upcoming episodes. I also want to remind everybody, we have a brand new Holzer's Ghosts episode. And this is a special one coming up Thursday, Tim.
Yeah.
It's going to be a live video stream on our YouTube channel and on our social media. Mark Anthony, one of our favorite guests and one of your favorite guests. You guys love every time Mark's on. We're going to talk about the curious case of Bishop Pike. It is a strange case involving supernatural, his inclusion into it, and his untimely death. This was a case that fascinated Dr. Holzer, and a case we'll never cover on the show, Holzer Files, but it was definitely a case that I thought was fascinating enough that I wanted to visit with it. So Mark Anthony, who is brushing up on all the history and story, will be here Thursday night live to do that with us. So make sure you check out. And if you have not yet subscribed to our YouTube channel, just go find it on YouTube, Darkness Radio, two separate words, Darkness Radio. Subscribe, hit the bell, hit the like, so that way you're always reminded when new stuff is posted up there, new content. And we do have some exclusive content you'll only find there. I did do a Q&A session with Shane Pittman this last week at the Phenomenology event. We're going to pull that and put it up on the YouTube channel as well, so that way anybody that missed the live video stream can find it. But we'll have that up, so there's going to be some cool new content coming, so keep checking it out. All right, let's do another news story here, Tim, and then we will take a quick break. This first story, actually, it's going to be two stories back to back, because one is an update to the other. But I got some really distressing news last week, okay, and I posted it on my social media. This was the headline from the Los Angeles Times. After decades of rocky seas in Long Beach, the Queen Mary is in danger of sinking. Can it be saved? In the 85 years since its maiden voyage, the RMS Queen Mary has survived rogue waves, transatlantic crossings, and even a world war. For the last five decades, it's enjoyed a second life docked in Long Beach, riding waves of popularity in tough times as a tourist attraction. But the historic ship is now facing its most challenging voyage yet. After years of neglect by a string of operators, the Queen Mary is so creaky and leaky that it needs $23 million in immediate repairs. According to a trove of court documents and inspection reports released last month, there's a growing concern that if something is not done, the ship could fall into critical disrepair and be in danger of sinking. I know a lot of people say it's not going to sink. It's in 30 feet of water, but you're missing the point is that it's going to collapse in on itself. Mm-hmm. The Queen Mary has long struggled as a tourist attraction, in part because of the inherent costs that come with maintaining such a large vessel. Its struggles led to a variety of failed proposals that would have sent it to Canada, New Zealand, and even back to England. But in 1992, the city fought a plan to move it to Hong Kong. In 1997, a promoter proposed sailing it to Japan for a few years as a way of raising money for repairs. But the city objected to that idea, too. At one point, Disney actually ran the Queen Mary as the center of an oceanside theme park, but that plan fell through as well. Now, the city's been trying to get the Queen Mary right for 40-plus years. Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia said during a news briefing last month, it's been from one leaseholder to the next, it has not succeeded to the point where there has been the right partner and the right preservation plan in place. The Queen Mary's current state of disrepair is extensive. Structural steel is corroded. The bilge system is aging. The hull compromised. And leaks and safety hazards abound, according to an April 28th inspection by city-hired marine engineering firm Elliott Bay Design Group, as first reported in the Long Beach Post. Since I posted this story, I've had people jumping on saying, that's not true, it's not this, it's not that. You didn't investigate the ship. You're not the city-hired marine engineer that went in and checked it out, so quit flapping your damn gums about shit you don't know, because I don't want people to turn away from the ship thinking that it's just being overblown. There are real problems. I was just on that ship. Just on that ship. There's no doubt there are some structural issues and that this ship needs to be saved. There were 10 years ago, Tim, when we were doing events aboard that ship. They had to close off areas because it was getting dangerous.
Yeah.
So to tell me that, no, it's not, and it's only in 30 feet of water, they're overblowing it, they're not. There's real problems. It's been docked in Long Beach since 1967. The ship is a longtime tourist attraction, hotel, and history buff destination that retains strong support from city leaders, including Garcia, who recently said it's important to preserve the ship's presence in the port city. But nobody seems willing to be able to pay for it. This is where it gets extremely irritating and frustrating for me, Tim. The city of Long Beach owns the Queen Mary, but officials said it's not their responsibility to make repairs on the ship that for decades has been leased out to operators. The current operator is locked into bankruptcy proceedings. Meanwhile, the ship could flood or even capsize within the next 2 years, according to the recent reports. Urgent category work items should be addressed immediately for safety from flooding in the next 2 years, court documents said, noting that the current status of various systems could lead to flooding throughout the ship, potential capsizing of the ship, and life safety and environmental issues. In the news briefing, Garcia said the ship is an important part of not just Long Beach history, but of the history of the country and its relationship with the United Kingdom. Many companies with ambitious plans have tried to keep the Queen Mary financially afloat. Now, over the years, operators have hosted music, food, and holiday festivals, including New Year's Eve and Halloween celebrations, Friday the 13th themed haunted room offerings that take advantage of the floating hotel's historical first-class interiors, and the Queen's Seaport Development Incorporated operated the vessel from 93 to 2005 before filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Save the Queen LLC faced similar financial woes in 2009. When LA-based real estate investment firm Urban Commons arrived in 2016, it came with the promise of a plan. The company signed a 66-year lease and within 3 years formed Eagle Hospitality Trust for the purpose of raising funds for a $250 million commercial development around the ship called Queen Mary Island. But in January, the trust and its affiliated entities filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, and with more than 500 $100 million in liabilities, along with a motion to sell their assets, including their leasehold interest in the Queen Mary. City officials said Urban Commons is still on the hook for failed lease obligations and have moved to block the sale of the lease to a new bidder until these issues can be remedied. The city's formal objection was filed May 14th, and court documents outlined additional urgent safety concerns on the vessel, including the ship's lifeboats and lifeboat support systems show significant signs of rotting and deterioration and need to be removed and replaced. The April inspection also found that critical items outlined in a 2015 survey were largely unstarted at this time. However, Howard Wu, a principal at Urban Commons, said in a statement that revenue all but dried up during the COVID-19 pandemic, which has made preservation resources difficult. However, we will continue to do whatever we can to help recover and to preserve a vibrant future, which we believe to be in the near horizon, Wu said. Some who know the Queen Mary best were not surprised by the eye-popping amount needed to preserve the vessel and said that the city bears blame for its own inaction. The city was never able to keep up with the maintenance on the ship, regardless of who they leased it to, said Ed Probonik, who spent nearly three decades as the Queen Mary's monthly inspector. He listed asbestos and electrical wiring issues as some of his top concerns about the ship's safety and stability. Probionic said that the city often tried to downplay his critical reports, which chronicled the ship's degradation for years. His contract was terminated in 2019. Although he has a fondness for the Queen Mary and would like to see it stabilized, Probonik said and worries that the amount of money and the amount of time it would take, I can't see who's going to step up and take responsibility. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in years of work. Beyond the immediate crucial repairs, the city has also raised questions about Urban Commons' use of COVID-19 relief loans, as well as its use of the $23 million in bond proceeds and Tidelands Trust funds issued in 2017 to address some of the ship's critical repairs, many of which have not been completed. The number is on top of the urgent $23 million in items outlined during the April inspection. Wu said that the company worked with the city to create a budget and that repairs were decided and planned together. So what's funny is the people that leased it to take care of it claimed it's not their responsible for the upkeep. The city claimed it wasn't their responsibility for the upkeep. So for around 25 years, Tim, this ship has just been slowly rotting and decaying.
Which is unusual because, okay, if you were to, let's say, rent a house from a landlord.
Right.
And in any state, especially the state of California, and you move in and let's say the pipes burst, you would assume the landlord would be the one to replace the pipes, not the occupant. So it makes no sense why the city of Long Beach isn't fixing these things.
Well, that's the updated story. Long Beach has taken back control now of the Queen Mary from the ship's operating company amid concerns that the 87-year-old vessel has not been properly maintained. That's what the city announced on Friday. For the first time in decades, Long Beach has now full control of the Queen Mary. We will be fully engaged in the preservation of this historic landmark and are incredibly grateful for this opportunity, Mayor Robert Garcia said in a statement. The former ocean liner turned floating hotel has been challenged to operate, with a 2017 study recommending that as much as $289 million worth of renovations and upgrades are needed. That's a lot of money. $23 million is just in immediate repairs to keep it from capsizing.
That's crazy.
But $289 million to get her back up. I don't know, buddy. I don't know how they can do something like that. I mean, unless you've got a Bezos or a Gates that are willing to step up. And I don't mean Josh Gates, right? Although maybe the guy is cornering the media market. But I don't know, man. I have a feeling that we may not see the Queen Mary open again, which breaks my heart.
Well, I mean, there are different ways to do that. You look at, in short, not spending a ton of time on this, but when you look at a city, when they go to build a stadium, they sell municipal bonds. They look at doing different things in order to raise that type of money to build a stadium that's worth $1 billion. A place like Long Beach, California, can do different things to raise that type of money in order to renovate the Queen Mary. You can do anything from, you know, gambling proceeds to, and I know some people may shirk and go, oh my God, gambling proceeds, or even in California, I don't know what the state you're going to laugh when I tell you this, even selling things from liquor taxes to, you know, or the typical sin taxes, liquor, legal weed, marijuana, yeah, stuff yeah. like that, in order to get that type of money to renovate the Queen Mary. Although you may have people who will protest using that type of money to renovate something like the Queen Mary, obviously it's a, what some people may call it, a vanity project, other people would call a necessity. So, because obviously once the ship hits bottom, it's not something that you can easily restore. I mean, that's, at that point you have, something that may come close to $1 billion in trying to renovate at that point, because you've got more problems. So you're better off taking the hit now and doing what you need to do to fix it, rather than letting it actually, you know, hit bottom. Then you've got more problems. So
crazy stuff. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got Theater of the Mind. We've got more stories. We've got your emails. And remember, we want to hear from you. 651-300-4977. Call in and share your paranormal encounters right here with us on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program, and we here at Darkness Radio are always about helping to preserve history, haunts, and the future. So what I've got is two different ways that we would like to step up and help the Queen Mary personally. Sleep with Tim Dennis for $25,000.
Yeah, yeah.
If you would like to do that, just contact me, dave@darknessradio.com. $25,000, and you are guaranteed 2 to 3 minutes of the best time of Tim's life. And if that's not enough for you, for just $100,000, I will give you Tim's home address and phone number. So email me if you have the funds, able to transfer, do these things. Tim and I, of course, will take the cursory 90% and then give 10% directly to the shareholders over at the Queen Mary. We're willing to help out.
Least we could do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm willing to do that. So if you're interested, that's the way to reach out. That's the way. I like it. I don't know about you, Tim, but that's the way I like it. Let's see. We've got some stories to read. I kind of feel like I want to dip into a story. Let's jump into this one. Dear Dave or Tim, I like that. Wow. I don't care who reads this, just somebody. This story freaked me out the other day, and I'm psyched. Gosh, you know what? I almost feel like, I'm a horrible tease. I'm going to read this guy's story, but I still want to get him on the show. So, Alfredo, expect a call. Dear Dave and Tim, or Dave or Tim, my name is Alfredo Lopez from Bakersfield, California. I'm retired as a California Highway Patrol sergeant, and I'll cut to the chase. My incident made it to the television program Real Stories of the Highway Patrol. Did I read this last week?
No, you and I were talking about it, but
okay.
I don't think you read it.
I remember talking. I'm just starting to worry that. Okay. So anyway, he goes, my incident made it to the television program Real Stories of the Highway Patrol. Well, a version of his story, but not the full story. He says, I have a copy of the full reenactment. I ended up fighting for my life for 11 minutes in a wool blend uniform in 106 degree heat. I was wearing a 27-pound Sam Brown holster. There were 3 bad guys in the car. They were drinking and tossing beer cans out of the window. I initiated an enforcement stop on the back roads of Kern County, California. I initially was just going to write a few tickets and have, get them for open alcohol containers. One thing led to another, and I ended up fighting to arrest one of the suspects for a felony warrant. The fight lasted 11 minutes. I attempted to call for backup, but when he hit the roadway, my radio shattered on the pavement. I was outnumbered and no backup coming. During this fight, I sustained a fractured nose, lacerated tongue, and both split lips. I sustained a laceration that split my eyelid and eyebrow completely in two. My cheekbone was fractured, and I lost 5 pounds in the fight from sweat and blood. And this, that's terrifying in its own. This is where it got demonic and spiritual. As I was losing the fight, I thought, I'm dying out here on this deserted road. Suddenly, I heard a smooth, non-gender voice that said, ask God for help. Looking back, I knew that voice was from my guardian angel. I was raised Catholic, and our nuns made us firm believers in guardian angels. At that exact moment, the suspect was on all fours when he looked back at me and told me in Espanol, you can't win. I'm going to kill you and leave you out here to die. His voice was guttural and inhuman-like. His strength was beyond anything I could handle. I was losing. There was blood all over my face, and I could barely see. His eyes turned completely black, unlike anything I had ever seen. During the fight, he bit down on my arm like a rabid pit bull. You see, I could never tell the real story to the producers because the highway patrol would have removed me from the road permanently. I know that the man I fought was demonically possessed. Turns out the suspect was heavily under the influence of drugs. The Monsignor I spoke to said, this is a common trick of demons to enter a person's body when they're not fully in control. I still have the facial scars, and more importantly, for better or worse, I have the mental scars forever. The suspect did not survive. I fractured his neck in a chokehold. If you want to see if I'm telling the truth, my badge number is, and I was a sergeant, I would be honored to speak to anyone to give all the exact details and how nasty the fight really got. As God is my witness, this actually occurred, and that came from Alfredo Lopez. We got to talk to this guy. I'd love to have him on the show and go in a little bit more in depth on this story. Maybe I'll even do it on a special live Thursday night show if he'd like to join us.
Yeah.
That's terrifying, dude. Could you imagine that?
Mm-mm. No.
Could you imagine you're a cop fighting for your life and this person's acting demonic and twisted? Drugs can do crazy things to people, no doubt.
Yeah, but, I have a friend who's I pray for him every day. He's a cop in South Minneapolis, and I can only imagine. I mean, he's dealt with some crazy scenarios over the past year, but I can only imagine something like that. I mean,
it's brutal. Brutal. Well, we're glad you're still with us, Alfredo. I'm going to give you a call. We're going to have you on the show. Childhood Haunted House Part 2. Dearest Dave and Tim, greetings again from South Central Indiana. I promised in my first letter that I would write you with more experiences from my childhood home, and well, here they are. In the first letter, I told you about my husband's experience the night before we turned over the keys to the house. I would love to give you more details on what he saw or experienced. However, his response has always been, shut up, we're not talking about it. I asked him again and received the same response. This event happened about 9 years ago, and he still has not told me. The upstairs of that house was as creepy as the basement. I do still firmly believe my mom checked in on my dad after her passing. We had a one-car attached garage right off the kitchen. My dad kept his van in there with all the doors locked and kept closed. The car alarm went off a couple of times in the garage. We were all in the house, and his keys were in a bowl on the table. My dad had a small stereo in his bedroom. It did not have the function to turn on automatically. You had to push a button and it would randomly turn on during the day while we were all in the living room or kitchen. Neither of the boys were home during these events. Now, fast forward to the morning of my dad's passing. I normally work at 4 a.m. in the morning, so I get up stupid early to get ready. And that particular morning, I was running about 10 to 15 minutes late. We were still sleeping in the dreaded basement at that time, and I went upstairs to the kitchen for coffee and to grab my lunchbox. I looked up and saw a shadow person cruise by in the living room. I moved very quickly from the right and left, going right by the front door. Right after the shadow passed the door, our house phone rang at 3:15 a.m. At this point, it was the nursing home calling to tell me that my father had just passed away. We continued to live in that house for one more year until we found our new home. We had our realtor over to review the paperwork for our offer. She was absolutely creeped out and left as soon as it was possible. She texted back later telling us to come to her office instead. She said, at least my place is haunted. She even had made those remarks a few times when we were house hunting. After we bought our current home, we still had to make it look good. And like the old house was occupied until the state of Indiana bought it. In the garage area on several occasions, there were strange lights witnessed by the next door neighbors who were not affected by the interstate going on. The garage had a door to the backyard and, of course, the garage door itself. We had the main garage door lever one place so the door couldn't be raised even manually. The back door was a normal steel door with a lock and a deadbolt. My dad had installed a brace and placed a 2x4 in it for extra security. In the meantime, we had all our utilities shut off. On the side of the garage, there was a window about 7 feet up. We received phone calls from the neighbors and police that strange lights were seen in the garage. My husband went over to meet the police and verified there was no evidence of a break-in. No glass broken, no doors unlocked or broken. There was no easy way to reach the window in the garage quietly and without being seen. So no sign of fire or any explanation for the lights. The day finally arrived when the house was torn down. We were then surrounded by the remaining neighbors to watch as it went. I was relieved when that house was gone. I still to this day, years later, hate going by what's left of the lot where the house once stood. I Googled the address to screenshot a pic for you. When I put in the address, all that comes up now is the rest of the vacant lot where the outline of the basement wall is still visible. The house was there, was where the group of bushes are in the middle of the little mound. Okay, so I'm taking a look at that. Thank you both so much for reading about my experiences in that damn house. You guys are still the best in the realm of paranormal. Keep up the great work. Sincerely, Tina. Thank you, Tina.
Yeah.
We appreciate that. What a great little weird tale of horror. Speaking of horror, I have a horror story from the time that Lady Gaga bought a $50,000 ghost detector, Tim.
That is horrible.
Tim would have come to your house for $20 and a bologna sandwich.
Yeah, well, with extra mayo and mustard.
Yeah, we all have that one person who seems to be around when you least want them to be. You feel their uncomfortable presence more often than not. And for most of us, it's a stalker ex you just can't get rid of. Or even that one chatty coworker. While these are beyond annoying, imagine being stalked around the world by a ghost named Ryan.
Mm.
That sounds like the current Karen situation.
Yeah.
Right? The over dramatized Karens everywhere. Ryan does have that same kind of connotation, especially as a ghost name, not as a human. But when you're going to get harassed by a ghost named Ryan, you just know things are not going to go well.
Yeah. And he's the kind of ghost that just like tips plates off the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a douche. He's kind of a college douche.
Yeah.
Is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, that was the case for the queen of the little monsters herself, Lady Gaga, Tim, as I like to call her.
Oh, Gaga.
Yeah. Lady Gaga. Yeah. Ryan first found his way from the spirit world into Gaga's troubled peripheral sometime during her 2010 Monster Ball tour. Well, when you call it Monster Ball, you got to expect to get some weird shit happening. He hasn't been doing anything too violent or scary, but she's freaked out by his presence. She's a very spiritual person and in tune with the spiritual world, but this is a step too far, even for her. That's what a friend of Gaga's tells the Daily Star. For months of the tour from country to country, she lamented about the unsettling spirit to crew members and close pals. She felt inklings of his presence in Dublin. By the time she got to Belfast, she found his hauntings to be far too much to handle any longer. She believes in paranormal activity, a source within the Star Circle explains to reporters, and won't take any risks when she's on the road. It's important to her to be safe from spirits. The spirit unnerved Gaga so much, she called in a medium and gathered friends to perform a seance to him in efforts to tap into the realm of the deceased. She was more than certain that Ryan was a bad omen. This might be true. Around the time of the seance, Gaga, as I like to call her, Tim, became the subject of some steep controversy. Images of her hoisting an Irish flag with a middle finger in her hand began circulating news headlines. That does sound like the work of a ghost named Ryan to me, Tim. Or you just were being stupid. So who'd she call? Ghostbusters! No, after the failed seance, Gaga took her paranormal witch hunt to a new extreme. According to Glamour, she spent $50,000 on a state-of-the-art electromagnetic field meter to detect ghosts.
Who sold her that one?
I don't know, Bill Chappell, we're going to have a conversation, sir.
Right, right.
Yeah, because, you know, I'd have been happy to sell it to her for $25,000 and still cut Bill in.
Right.
Banishing unwanted spirits back from whence they came is certainly a hefty price tag, but the massive $320 million net worth Gaga has prepared to stop at nothing to be free of the ghost Ryan. Oh, Ryan, please. In the midst of her efforts to find peace of mind, Gaga... You know, people are just like, Dave, it's Gaga. Stop it. You're pissing me off. Well, it's our show, so Gaga it is. Continued to make costly purchases that only A-listers like herself could afford. A couple of backhanded compliments throughout this. Yeah, along with the detector, she also dealt out another $50K to enlist the assistance of a NASA chemist. They helped her construct a non-hot substance that would release steam out of a teacup-shaped dress she would be wearing on stage, according to Showbiz Cheat Sheet. The overall cost for her private jet to travel the paranormal equipment and costumes across the world racked up to around $700,000. At this point, it's clear that Gaga is a pretty big spender.
How do you get in that circle?
I don't know, but tap me in, please. The star has also had a sensitivity towards spiritual energies. This made her run in with Ryan all the more demoralizing. Yeah, how do you like that? Oh, what chased you out? Was it Beelzebub? Was it Satan? Was it Baphomet? No, it was Ryan. That's so demoralizing right there to be run out of your home by a ghost named Ryan. Hey, I don't know if you guys saw, but the rugby match is on. You mind if I turn on your TV? And boo, by the way. Right? Gaga has been quite candid in speaking out about her past drug abuse, and she ascended to fame at the young age of 19. Lady Gaga, better known as Stephanie Germanotta, is that how you say it? Had lived as a high school dropout, working three jobs to support herself. She spent most of her days alone in her apartment. It's as just my piano and myself, Gaga recounts to Rolling Stone. I had a television, and I would leave it on all the time just to feel like somebody was hanging out with me. The soon-to-be star would find herself indulging in cocaine. Oh, it was like the drug was my friend. I never did it with other people, she continues. It's such a terrible way to fill that void because it just adds to that void because it's not real. Luckily, an epiphany came her way in the form of a past relative. Gaga attributes her successful battle with addiction to the guiding spirit of her Aunt Joanne. The life of her father's sister, who Gaga's fifth studio album takes namesake, was imprinted in the singer's mind as the spitting image of artistic freedom. Joanne passed at the early age of 19, living behind a legacy of poetry and paintings. Gaga still feels particularly entwined with her aunt, even saying that she is Joanne's incarnation. I had a spiritual vision. I had to finish her business, the singer says. While Ryan may have been an unwanted visitor in Gaga's life, it seems like he's since gone back to the spirit world or just went off to haunt someone else. Luckily, the singer still has that $50,000 ghost detector for if he ever returns.
Yeah, lucky. Can you just see her trying to communicate with Ryan? Ryan, it's Gaga. I want you to leave me. Leave me alone. Leave Gaga, oh, Gaga alone.
You're so gauche, Gaga. Good Lord. this is weird. An entire village has become abandoned overnight, and it's now haunted.
No.
Located just 20 kilometers from the desert town of Jaisalmer in Rajasthan, Koldahara. It's earned its reputation as a site for paranormal activities. The abandoned village has been that way for a little over a century, and anyone who's ever tried to occupy it has supposedly witnessed the paranormal activity. For some time now, the village of Koldahara has been a source of immense speculation and fascination for those who have interest in the supernatural. Sometime at the turn of the last decade, the abandoned village came into the public eye when people started writing about the paranormal experiences they had at Koldahara. Several studies have suggested that the village was abandoned over a period of time for reasons such as the drying up of the wells and excessive taxes by the Prime Minister, Salim Singh. Legends, however, have a different story to tell, and the Prime Minister plays a crucial role in them. Salim Singh, often called Zalim Cruel Singh, was a high-profile prime minister to the king of Jaisalmer. He was so powerful that he proceeded to build a house that would be taller than the palace of the king himself. This upset the king, who dispatched his soldiers and had the uppermost floor of the house demolished so that his palace would continue to be the tallest in the land. His shenanigans notwithstanding, Salim Singh continued to remain an important courtier of the Jaisalmer state, and his powers were largely unchecked, Tim. Salim Singh, the legend goes, could get away with murder, and this was something he was well aware of. Even as he continued to raise taxes on the locals, Salim also couldn't keep his eyes off the ladies. His lust turned him to a girl in Kuldahara, who he demanded be sent over to his chambers that very night. The villagers, not having a choice, agreed, but requested that the soldiers return the next day to collect her. Having packed off the soldiers, the villagers proceeded to sacrifice the girl and gather their belongings and leave the village for good. There was nothing left in the village for them. With the taxes being what they were, and certainly having earned the prime minister's wrath after killing the girl he'd laid eyes on, was all the sign they needed. Maybe I'd have given her the option. Hey, do you want to have sex with that guy, or should we just murder you now?
Wow.
Do you think that's how the conversation went?
Probably, I'm guessing,
When the soldiers returned the next day, not only did they find the dead girl, they also saw that the entire village that was populated just the previous day had been abandoned. Little else is known of what followed, but the legend grew. Legend has it that the spirit of the dead girl haunts the village. Over the course of several decades, the story of Kuldahara would be spoken about in whispers till it exploded onto the internet a little over 10 to 12 years ago. Rajasthan Tourism decided to cash in on its reputation and began promoting it as a tourist site. The locals may not believe the legend, but it's equally true that no one has ever lived in the abandoned village of Kuldahara. And that's why, folks, if you're interested, you can visit Tim at 314 Heritage in Kuldahara. No, I'm telling him about your home in Kuldahara, Tim. So I they can need... go by and see the blown Dave, out walls in Kuldahara.
Dave, that's my vacation slum home.
Slum home.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to help you out, man.
I don't need people dropping by the cardboard box, all right?
Wow. You are just shameful.
I know.
Shameful.
I know.
But you know what time it is, Tim? It is time to dig deep. We've got a new Parashare Theater of the Mind. This recorded from a listener, and I'm excited that we're able to actually open this up and share it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for a brand new Theater of the Mind from the real experience of Michael Judd, the story of twos.
Hello, Dave and Tim. This is Michael. You know how everybody says that things happen in threes to mock the Trinity? Well, this story, everything seems to happen in twos. And by the end, I think you'll see why. I think that something was trying to scare the deuce out of me. So the story starts with two boys, both of them at the age of two, in two different cities, and the boys are born 2 years apart. These are my children. So, the first one, 2 years old, St. Louis, Missouri. My wife and I are laying in bed, and our son is laying in between us, because he often slept in the bed with us. And he starts looking really nervously toward the end of the bed. And then he starts to hide his face under the covers, and then he looks back, and he gets this really mad look on his face, and then he'd hide his face under the covers again. And finally we're like, "What are you doing?" And he says, "The bad man keeps staring at me." And of course we're like, "What bad man?" He goes, "The bad man, he's at the end of the bed. And he's staring at us." Which my wife and I then look at each other and we're like, just go to sleep and ignore him. It'll be fine. He'll go away. Which my son lays down and goes to sleep. Needless to say, neither one of us slept for quite a while. Now, I had to move because of a job, so we moved to city number two, Kansas City. Had another boy. And when he was 2 years old, lying in bed with us again, he starts looking to the side of the bed, and he's like, "Stop it." And then he'd turn back, and he'd look back over, and he'd tell her, whatever it was, "Stop it again." And we're like, what are you doing? He says, there's an angry man standing next to the bed, and he's staring at us. At this point, we were like, really? So once again, we tell him, well, just close your eyes. He'll go away. You'll be able to go to sleep. It'll be okay. And again, my wife and I did not get much sleep that night. Now, this has happened to us twice, luckily, not since then, but it's just fascinating that it was two cities, two boys, two different times, both of them at the age of two. Well, thank you for listening to my story, and I'll share more later. Thank you.
Very cool. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We appreciate that, Michael. And again, if you guys would like to record your own self-telling stories, we will play them on an upcoming episode of Theater of the Mind. Or if you just want to call into our Voices from Beyond voicemail and share a story, we'll play it as one of our callers. 651-300-4977. Or you can continue to be lazy and make me do all the work by sending in your emails and I'll just read them here.
Wow. I mean, maybe they love your voice, Dave. Maybe they want to hear their spooky experience through your dulcet tones.
Could be.
Yeah.
Our next story takes us to Glendora, California. It sounds like a fake name to me, Glendora.
Wasn't that one of the witches on Bewitched?
Yes, Glendora.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love the movie Glengarry Glendora.
Oh, that's a good one.
Alec Baldwin's brother Billy in the role. Bruce Olav Solheim understands why casual readers might be skeptical. Anzar the Prognators. How do you say it? Prognitors.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anzar the Prognitor. That just seems like a word with prognitor. I've never heard the word. How could I have not heard this word?
Prognitor?
Let's just call it Anzar. Anzar is a true story of my connection with an ancient alien mystic. He said in an interview from his home in California, if you would have told me 10 years ago that I would be talking to an ancient alien mystic, I would probably have tried to avoid eye contact and politely but quickly walked away. But things have changed quite a bit for me in the last few years. Solheim spends the first half of his latest book explaining how the alien world, the spirit world, and the quantum world connect. That's really how all of this relates. He said, I've had a paranormal life since I was 4 or 5 years old. Weird things have always happened to me my entire life, not just alien stuff, but ghosts and telepathy and all of it. Solheim took a risk to share these details of his life as a distinguished professor of history at Citrus College in Glendora, California. He understands the consequences of revealing the deeper events in his life. As a tenured professor, I was afraid I would lose my job. He said, that's similar to a lot of other scientists, professionals, and professors. They don't want to talk about it for fear of losing their grant money or whatever. The death of Solheim's friend in 2016, though, changed all of that. He says, my friend came to me in a vision and told me that it was time to tell my story. Solheim said, I mustered up the courage to do so. I wrote 3 books that documented 89 different paranormal experiences I've had, including extraterrestrial types of things. This book is separate and different from that. It just focuses on Anzar, who I've been in continuous contact with since 2018 during my spirit walks that I do several times a week. Boots to Books published Anzar the Prognitor in May to great acclaim. In less than a month, the book is listed in a top 30 books and educator biographies on Amazon, ahead of the Kindle version of Tuesdays with Maury, An Old Man, A Young Man, and Life's Greatest Lessons by Mitch Albom. Anzar is available in print and in electronic form. We'll put that up in our shop as well. Just go to darknessradio.com, click on the store tab. It'll take you to our Amazon page. You can find paranormal, you can find true crime, you can find gift items, what to watch. We've got all kinds of great stuff there. And remember, by going there and purchasing through that Amazon link, a little portion, very small portion, goes to help our Twinkie addiction.
Yep.
That's all. Just a Twinkie addiction.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to say in his book, we can no longer wait for government disclosure about UFOs and aliens. The time has come for personal revelation through a leap of consciousness in a new era of reconversion. We're all related and we're all the aliens. The second half of the book highlights his communication with Anzar, out of what came some pretty remarkable things, if I do say so myself. Some prophecies, predictions, some preparation, Solheim said. I wanted to share those things with people, knowing that there would be some eye rolling and stuff. But because of where we are at as a society, a lot of people are a little bit more open to thinking about these things. And to put it in Anzar's words, he would say people are ready to take the leap of consciousness. Solheim approaches skepticism of his story with understanding. I'm skeptical too, he said. When I hear something that I haven't heard before, skepticism is a natural human tendency. It's what keeps us from being snookered. Hey, man, this is a family show. What kind of freaking conversation is snookered, Tim?
Right.
Yeah, he says he keeps us from being snookered by charlatans. That's just something you learn as an adult. But when it continues to happen over and over, it's what Anzar says, that experiencing is believing and believing is experiencing. And I am the walrus, cuckoo, kachoob, Tim.
That's a great band name, by the way, Snookered by Charlatans.
Yeah. That's a great, let's find some boy bands and put them together.
Yeah.
His friend who died encouraged Solheim by telling him that he already believed in so many fantastic things. Why couldn't he believe in one more fantastic thing? I don't get mad at skeptics. I sympathize with them, Solheim said. I've been there. But once you have enough experiences, you just can't be skeptical anymore, at least not about the things you've experienced. Solheim teaches regular history classes and also teaches classes in the paranormal. I get skeptics in that class, and I get fellow professors that come to the class with the idea of debunking my ideas, he said. But by the time a class is over, I can't exactly say that they're true believers, but I can say at least that they're agnostics, and that's kind of fun. The author has been a guest on late-night talk shows several times in his career. I think we should get him on. I think we've had him on Darkness Radio in the past on his other books, but we should reach out to him and talk to him about this new book. What do you think, Timmy D?
I think so, yeah.
Anzar, the progenitor.
The progenitor?
Progenitor. Is that what it is? That sounds right. Anzar, the progenitor. Now watch, he'll be like, no, it's Anzar, the progenitor. It's a true story of contact with an ancient alien. So I'm going to reach out to old Dr. Solheim and see if we can get him on to chat a little bit further about his experiences and his stories. Here's one, Tim. Here's a story near and dear to my heart, because this actually happened to my family. A woman claims her stepdad called the family after he died. This is the voicemail that a woman claims was left by her stepdad after he passed away. The TikToker, at Princess Guard, posted the video on her account with the caption, "True story. This is how I know the afterlife exists. Paranormal talk, witches, ghosts." It was all the little hashtags. An explanatory text on the video itself reads, "Thinking about how my stepdad called us after he died in an accident in 2012. He died on April 2012, and this message happened on August 2012. So she's claiming that it is her late stepdad who left a voicemail 4 months after his passing. The message left behind says, guess who? Guess who? Up now to the video has been watched about 1.7 million times and has more than 380,000 likes and 10,000 comments. Some of the people replying to the post said that they felt negative vibes, with one writing, "I instantly got the chills and my eyes began watering. That's definitely an evil spirit." Another added, "Nope, that's demonic. I got chills when the voice played." A third person agreed, "That's an evil spirit or something. I got chills and a bad gut feeling." He's got chills, Tim. They're multiplying, and he's losing control, because the power that call's supplying, it's electrifying, but you better shape up. No? Sorry. Slipping into our old DJ and bouncer days, Tim.
Yep.
Yeah. Remember that when we'd always get the Grease Lightning request and Paradise by the Dashboard Lights? Both songs are completely ruined to me now.
Then I'd have to pull out the sledgehammer and hit the turntables real hard. And
yeah. Good God.
Claim they were broken and I couldn't play that.
Yep.
Yep.
This video will be up so you can hear the audio. I would have played it, but it's really kind of quiet on our line. And it's just the voice saying, guess who? So it's kind of weird. It's not really that dramatic, but you can check it out and it's up on our page. Phone calls from the dead. I like that.
Now, is guess who really demonic? I mean, you know,
if it comes through this way, Guess who? Yeah, that's demonic. But it just come through normal, like, guess who, bitch? Then you've been like, oh, stepdad, you're such a prankster. I don't know. Hey, paranormal investigators are doing the good work of law, Tim.
Yeah?
Yeah, mystery surrounds the discovery of a human skull found in the Bolton Woodland. Uh-huh. It's been there 3 months, it's been 3 months since a human skull was found in the wooded area in Bolton, but it's still not known who the deceased man is or how he died. The human remains were discovered in an abandoned former hotel in Edgerton after midnight on March 1st. A couple who described themselves as paranormal investigators came across the skull in a wooded area down a track from a few hundred meters from Blackburn Road. The shocked eyewitnesses called the police to the scene at about 12:20 a.m. that morning and have since been assisting investigators with their inquiries. At the time, they claimed that an army-style jacket was found close to the remains. Forensic investigators scoured the undergrowth surrounding the derelict hotel. However, Greater Manchester Police say no further items or evidence have been retrieved. A police cordon stretching across part of the former hotel and the surrounding woodland was in place for a number of days with officers standing guard. In the days that followed, police sent the skull for DNA assessments. 2 weeks later, detectives reported that the skull was likely to be that of a male. It was also likely that he was less than 50 years old, but the exact age of the deceased person is still not known. His identity and how he met his end also remains unclear. Investigators are keeping an open mind, but detectives seem certain that the death does not relate to the ongoing investigation. Inquiries into whether the man's death is linked to any known missing person or ongoing. Responding to a request for an update this week, a GMP spokesperson said the investigation is ongoing. Forensics are yet to determine the age of the person or how they died. It's still not being linked to any other open investigation, and inquiries are ongoing as to whether it's linked to a missing person, but there is nothing to suggest this either at the moment. Nothing was found close to the scene that provided any further evidential lines of inquiry. No one has been charged in relationship with the incident. Police were called to report a suspicious item being found off Blackburn Road at around 12:35 a.m. on Monday, March 1st. Officers attended and found what they described as possible human remains in an undergrowth outside the hotel. A cordon was put in place and police were alerted to search the undergrowth surrounding the derelict hotel continued for several days. At the time, Detective Inspector Debbie Hurst of Greater Manchester Police's Bolton CID said it was a very surprising discovery. We have been working ever since to establish the circumstances here. I wonder if it's, could just be that somebody might have died out in the woods and a wolf, scavenger ate it and dropped the skull off somewhere else.
That could be, yeah. I mean, it's not unusual for something like that to happen. It's
not unusual, yeah, to find skulls out in the woods. Do, 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 do. I like it, Tim. Maybe we can sing that as our first song, as the new band name you just entitled it. What was it?
Something of Charlatans. Yeah. Scoundrels or Charlatans or Charlatans and Scoundrels.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Very interesting. So here's a question for you, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Was a ghost to blame for terrorizing Dundee streets back in 1901?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then I guess we don't need to read the story. Thank you. Let's move on. No, it was November of 1901, and there was little sunlight hours, with only gas lamps flickering in the winter breeze, giving any assistance to locals finding their way home. You would be forgiven for already being a bit spooked by the dark surroundings, so it was no surprise that when sightings of a ghostly robber in Dundee were reported, many of the city's women and men were afraid of what was going bump in the night. But was everything really as it seemed? On December 9th of 1901, the Evening Telegraph reported on Dundee's police's newest investigation. They were on the look for a ghost. Or at least they were looking to apprehend the male who might be masquerading as a paranormal figure, injecting fear into all that heard of him. With many residents refusing to leave their homes, unluckily for commercial traveler Gilbert Scott, he encountered the ghoul twice within 2 weeks whilst walking to his home on Perth Road. The first occasion was on Tuesday, November 19th, when walking along Magdalen Yard Road, just before 11 p.m., Gilbert was alone, and the weather was dark and stormy. It was in some ways the perfect conditions for an assault or an unprepared passerby with ill lighting and few pedestrians on the street. unaware of what would literally hit him as he turned the corner. Gilbert walked onto step row and at the same moment was struck by a blow on the chest that knocked him off the pavement and into a puddle of water in the middle of the road. For a brief moment, Gilbert had no understanding of what had just happened. He had been walking with his head bent to protect himself from the ferocious winds, and he hadn't seen what had struck him. Gilbert got to his feet, and he caught eyes with a figure standing on the pavement. The figure, clad in white, was under the flickering street lamp that threatened to extinguish with each gale of wind. The shocked victim was able to dispel the idea that he was in the presence of a supernatural being, and the white-robed man rushed to him, seizing him by the throat and forcing him back up against the wall. Gilbert was able to grapple and grip the assailant with all of his strength. A struggle began, with the attacker keeping a powerful grip on his victim's throat, almost knocking him unconscious. He tried to shout for help as he saw a tall man watching from just a few yards away. However, the onlooker decided he wasn't in the fighting mood and refused to pay attention to the pleas for assistance. Managing to get one of his arms free, Gilbert was able to land a pretty decent blow to the jaw of the ghost, forcing him to lose his grip, sending him tumbling to the ground. He was back on his feet in an instant, though, and attacked Gilbert once more. However, this time, the victim was prepared. Gilbert managed to land several blows to his opponent's face, resulting in the man gathering up his white sheet ensemble in his arms and running swiftly along Magdalen Yard Road toward the city center. By this time, Gilbert was too exhausted and in no condition to follow, and instead made his way home, where on arrival, members of his family were shocked at his appearance. His clothes covered in mud and his face was camouflaged with dirt and blood. Instead of reporting his assault to the police, Gilbert decided he would be taking the law into his own hands. He gathered a group of friends, all armed with heavy sticks, Tim, and visited Step Row each night for a week in hope of meeting the man who attacked him. But their ghost hunt was unsuccessful. With Gilbert's description of the ghost, it seemed almost ridiculous that the assailant thought the disguise would make him seem like a real paranormal entity. The man was described as about 5'6" and stoutly built. He had dark hair and a dark mustache, Tim, although he wore a bonnet drawn over his eyes. The ghost part of his outfit was the most astonishing. It literally only consisted of a white sheet which reached down below his knees and was tied at the back of his neck, almost as if he had run from a barber shop without paying. Despite the hunt proving unsuccessful with his pals, Gilbert would once again come face to face with the ghostly assailant in the exact same spot. After visiting a friend's house, he once again turned the corner onto Step Row. However, this time he walked into the middle of the road, which was fortunate for him as the man in white was waiting for another unsuspecting passerby on the pavement. As soon as the attacker saw Gilbert, he rushed past and was lost in the darkness. Gilbert ran up Step Row, Tim, and summoned nearby constable, but their efforts to discover the whereabouts of the ghost were fruitless. An inspector arrived soon after with an inspection on the neighborhood carried out, only to come to the same conclusion. Following the hunt, the police announced their investigation, assuring locals that everything that could be done was being done to punish the unknown scoundrel. During the following weeks on Magdalen Yard Road and Belfield Avenue, they were alarmed by the ringing of their doorbells in the small hours of the morning, which were attributed to the attacker. The report from the Times said, in all likelihood, this is the work of a desperate character who parades in the streets in an unearthly-looking garb, apparently for the purpose of robbing and injuring lonely pedestrians. We could find no reference to the culprit being charged, so it seems he really did manage to escape, like a ghost in the night. Now, in the early 1900s, we're obviously awash with street hauntings, especially in the local area, Tim. Around the same time as the Magdalen Yard ghost was at large, there was another unwelcome visitor on the streets of Balgowrie. I don't know how to say that, so I'm just going to go with Blairgowrie.
Sounds good.
For weeks, spooks had been putting up shivers on communities as far apart as Kirkmichael and Newtile. Lame names. But when they tried their tricks with a farmer driving a carriage home from Blairgowrie one late November night, they met their match. A party of ghosts suddenly appeared at the side and then tore past him with alarming speed. The farmer coaxed his horse into a sprint and began to deal the specters a thrashing with his whip. He tanned their naked hides as he crashed on, and the ghouls scattered. The next day, however, an inquiry began into the attack on the members of the Belguire Harriers, who had been out training in white jerseys and pants. The East Perthshire hauntings also made headlines at the time and warranted a police inquiry of their own. The visitor from neither regions first appeared in Longfarren before flitting towards Meigle and Aelith. In Meigle, a young girl who said to have died out of fright when she saw a ghoulish phosphorescent face as she drew her curtains. Perthshire Chief Constable John McPherson said he was confident the hauntings were a hoax perpetrated by the son of a wealthy Dundee businessman, but still the panic continued in that small town, Tim. Ridiculous. So ridiculous.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Mobster John Panisi, Tim, is in the news, and not for what you think.
Not for being mob-like?
For this, Tim, it was a ghost he couldn't refuse. Lucchese mobster John Panisi says he got an earth-shattering message from the great beyond via his deceased grandparents. They convinced him to become a rat, a government turncoat, Tim.
Oh, no.
The paranormal message came to him in his Long Island home just as he was praying before a photo of his late grandparents and seeking their advice about whether he should turn informant. He said in a recent podcast, just at that moment, Panisi says he heard a sudden loud rattling of dishes and glasses. Everything began shaking in the house. That was the sign, Panisi said, that convinced him to turn himself into the FBI in October of 2018. In three trials where he was testified since becoming a government witness, Panisi has never mentioned this poltergeist-style encounter in his sworn testimony. Panisi said he flipped after Lucchese, or is it Lucchese? I can't.
Lucchese.
Lucchese, that's what it is. Family members wrongly tagged him as a rat. In the podcast, Panisi also offered dramatic new details on attempts on his life that he believes had been ordered by his former Lucchese allies shortly before receiving the supernatural message from the other side. He was chased by five or six bloods at a Manhattan job site. Panisi said the hoodlums were lying in wait to kill him for the Lucchese's. I couldn't believe the level of disrespect they had stooped to, Panisi said. He said the Lucchese clan had started using other ethnic groups. They began using the bloods. On another occasion, he said that he had chased off another group of bloods with a pistol and a knapsack. Is that what the kids are calling it these days? Beware my pistol and a knapsack. These encounters, he said, underscored his uneasiness due to mixed messages he was getting from the family's acting boss, Michael Big Mike DeSantis. Panisi, who had recently moved, said, I started seeing people laying around at the train station in a new town that I lived in. He said that when a cousin suggested he go to the FBI, he rejected the notion, but his son suggested they write down the pros and cons of the options he faced. As a last resort, said Panisi, they wrote down the FBI. That was the other option. It was the first time that I even thought of the government or the FBI. We just had to put it down as a last resort. Panisi said his son, who lost 17 years without his father during the years Panisi was in prison for killing a neighborhood rival, was a nervous wreck. Panisi said his son knew I was going to either go to jail for the rest of my life, get killed, or I'm going to be in some type of war with these guys, and I'm on the losing end. I'm one person, and he told me, I think that you should go tomorrow. And it was a Thursday, and I said, all right. So we left.
It's hard once you start doing that voice to get out of it and start reading regular, ain't it?
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
You start doing
the ghost of his grandparents stole the mate. Knock it the hell off. Turn yourself in. Become a rat, you son of a bitch.
Hey, here's the deal. You don't want to keep doing this lifestyle, so I'm going to go rattle a few dishes or something.
Yeah. Hey, boo over here.
Boo.
Clinkety clank.
Hey, grandson, here's the deal. I got to get true to you. What can I do here? Let's see. What would make you turn right?
Keep this shit up, and I'm afraid we're gonna wake up to a horse head in our bed, Tim.
Let's see. I could hit you over the head with a sausage. I could, let's see, what else could I do? I could put a little something in your spaghetti. No, hey.
My spaghetti, Tim, my spaghetti.
I could, I could make you slip on some gravy. No, I'm going to rattle your plates.
Boo, boo and such.
Boo.
Hey, a piece from James Dean's Porsche Spyder, which he met his death in during a car collision in 1955, was recently sold to Zach Baggins, host of Travel Channel's hit paranormal series Ghost Adventures. Baggins, of course, purchased the piece from an auction as he was feeling drawn to its cursed aura. The part in question is the infamous car's four-speed transaxle,
which, yes, transaxle. All
right. How much do you think he paid for the transaxle from the infamous Spyder that destroyed, blew up, and has been known to kill people since the loss of James Dean?
I'm going to go $15,000.
Zach Baggins would laugh at you for $15,000.
Well, he's been known to do that, yeah.
$386,000.
Oh, my God.
The wrecked car was reportedly sold by Dean's insurance company to another Southern California racer. The listing states, and the transaxle was later separated from the vehicle before being placed in storage now for several decades. This piece is reportedly one of the few pieces to make it out of the wreckage of Dean's last moment. His grim demise came as he entered an intersection on his way to race in Salinas. He died on his way to the Robles War Memorial Hospital. Now, initially, the buyer for the piece was anonymous, but it was soon revealed that Baggins rose to the top of the bidding, acquiring the part at its 42nd bid. TMZ, who broke the story, states the transaxle's rep as an eternally doomed piece of equipment is obviously what drew him to the purchase. The macabre fanatic has quite the hobby for acquiring doomed pieces, from spending $11,000 on one of the original Chucky dolls from Child's Play to getting his hands on the famous clown doll from Poltergeist. He has quite the collection of bone-rattling items. But I started giggling, Tim, because I just saw his picture.
Yeah.
In this article, and he looks a lot like Randy Quaid from Christmas Vacation. He's standing outside with a robe on and one of those Elmer Fudd hats.
Yeah.
Right, you're just waiting. Hey, the shitter's full, you know, pumping poop into the local gutter system.
You know,
here, I'm going to send it. You got to see it just because it is funny.
Okay.
And the story will again be up so people can go check it out. But I just, like I said, as I'm scrolling, that was not the picture. I've seen so many pictures of him looking tough, you know, and in his tight T-shirts and looking good. And then you scroll by and there's Cousin Eddie buying James Dean's car. Oh, good grief. Seeing as how
Look at that.
Yeah. Holy. Yeah, right?
Wow.
Seeing as how it's allegedly one of the rare intact pieces to come from Dean's fatal car crash, Baggins has much bigger plans for the new cursed transaxle. He's planning to exhibit the piece in a spooky haunted museum located in downtown Las Vegas. The piece would certainly fit in with the rest of Baggins' creepy, or as it says in here, creppy auction finds, like sticking self-portraits of serial killer John Wayne Gacy. Maybe it'll sit next to Charles Hansen's dentures. Who the hell wrote this article?
Charles Hansen's dentures?
Yeah, Charles Hansen. You know, he was Manson's roommate.
Yeah.
Or Ted Bundy's glasses, maybe.
Right, right.
Yeah, Ted Bundy and Charles Hansen. It's clear that Baggins has an affinity for the macabre, so it's only fitting that the transaxle present for the death of one of the world's most beloved leading men gets into his hands. So that's it for Supernatural News Parashare this week, folks. Thanks for tuning in, spending some time with us. Remember to go check out darknessradio.com. Look at all the different tabs. You can find our shop there where you can find all the cool books and things we talk about on the show. You can also check out the events tab to find out where we're going to be throughout the year. So check that out. We'll be back again tomorrow. We've got another brand new episode of the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. I hope you guys will tune in and check that out. And the show that we're doing tomorrow is Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, Werewolves, Ghosts, and Screaming Skulls with Charles Christian right here. And then remember, tomorrow night, live, Darkness Radio presents Holzer's Ghost, The Curious Case of Bishop Pike. We'll be talking about that. That's tomorrow on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Dave, that's Tim, and this is Darkness Radio.